Hello and welcome to the inaugural Canary Pod. Each week we're going to be going through the most read stories on the Canary and getting behind those headlines. This week we're going to be talking about two reports, both authored by Canary journalist Steve Topple. So Steve's going to join me today and walk you through these two stories we're going to be covering. The first is a report by the UN on the Conservative Party, and the second we're going to be discussing the Tory dirty money scandal. So welcome, Steve.
Good morning, Mrs. Mendoza. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. It's been a long week though, hasn't it, Steve?
It's been a very long week. A long couple of weeks, actually. This election is rolling on, and as a journalist, it's quite intense reporting on it. So, yeah, long couple of weeks.
Absolutely. I mean, it has been extraordinary, hasn't it? Like the level, I mean, we're all putting out more articles than we've ever put out before. We're having a readership which is expanded beyond belief. And I think with that kind of level of attention on us, it can kind of be quite nerve-wracking, can't it? Kind of feeling that pressure and that obligation to really get it right every time for every single reader.
Absolutely. I think for me, what a lot of the pressure is that there is an expectation almost, if you like, with the Canary, that we're going to come up with some real wow stories, that no one else is reporting this and this has been buried and the Conservatives are hiding this and the mainstream media has done that. And it's not that those stories aren't out there, because they are, as we're going to discuss today. But it's a real challenge. And there is just so much stuff being buried and so much stuff being hidden from the public. It's a constant day in, day out battle at the moment.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, certainly, especially given the two stories that we're going to cover in a moment, the devil really is in the detail. And it does take a lot of time in research and fact checking and everything else to get those stories to fruition.
Absolutely.
So why don't we take a look, beginning at the UN report, Steve? What is this story about? What have the UN said? How has it impacted people?
Okay, so the UN Human Rights Committee does a 5-yearly periodic review of every country that has signed up to the international human rights obligations that the UN sets out. Like I said, it does this every 5 years, and it reviews how a country is performing regarding its human rights. So 2017, the UK was up for another review, and the UN has completed this, and it made a huge 227 recommendations. Now, I didn't put this in the article, but to put it into a bit of context, it also did at the same time India and Brazil. Now, for better or for worse, these countries are viewed in the West, if you like, as slightly third world, slightly behind us. India had 252 recommendations, and Brazil had 270. So they are not far off
what?
Us.
What?
Yeah, I didn't put that in the article, I know. They are not far off us in terms of their performance, for want of a better word, regarding human rights. So, yeah, that's the kind of scale of it. But in terms of what the UN said and what the report concluded, it was overarching. I mean, you talk about how much time we take researching stories and getting our facts and figures correct. I mean, this was a 60-page document that I worked through to come to this smallish article that you saw. And like I say, their recommendations and criticisms were overarching. It veered from everything from the child sexual abuse inquiry, saying that the government wasn't doing enough regarding high-level child sexual abuse and that this inquiry must be completed. Saying that counter-terrorism legislation must be changed because it currently targets, and I quote, individuals or groups based on race, ethnic background or religion. On that note, it also says the government needs to do more regarding racial profiling, specifically from people of African descent in this country, because law enforcement agencies and the court system are racially profiling people based on where they've come from. It talks about child poverty, which is currently sat at 4 million children, which it must eradicate. And it went on and on and on. Some of the largest areas it spoke about, for example, were the government's approach to hate crime. It made 42 recommendations based on how the government is performing regarding hate crime. Specifics included saying that the government has to do more to stop the British media inciting hate crime. That it needs to do more regarding Northern Ireland, where currently same-sex couples aren't allowed to get married. That says it has to bring legislation in Northern Ireland in line with the rest of the UK. And it says it generally needs to do more to stop the increase of hate crime and discrimination that's been witnessed after Brexit.
So hang on, Steve. We've got, I mean, these are serious issues. We're talking about child poverty, child abuse, racial profiling, media bias and a lack of integrity in the media. Where does this report go from here? Like, what has been, well, before we get there, what has been the reaction from the Conservative government that's been accused of this and from the media that has also been accused?
Okay, so the government has either denied a lot of these claims or they said that they have done A, B and C and that D, E and F are a work in progress and are coming. But the thing is, Kerry, this is a usual reaction from the government. We had two UN reports last year along these same lines, which we can touch on in a little while. And again, the government just dismisses them. They ignore them. Now, look, I want to make my position clear on this. I don't consider the UN to be a faultless, wonderful bastion of maintaining and promoting human rights on this planet. They are, in essence, they're toothless, they are ineffective, and they do not do the job they were formed to do in the first place. However, that doesn't mean you can dismiss what they say. This is crucial stuff. And as I say, the government has dismissed or saying they're currently working on it. The media, as far as I'm aware, and I keep checking, hasn't even reported on this. There has been no widespread coverage of this story, which in itself I think says a lot about the media. And also what was submitted with this, which was interesting, was Reporters Without Borders, Reporters Sans Frontières, submitted their evidence as well to this about the UK being 40th now in the Press Freedom Index. That was made up part of
That result, I think, the lack of reporting on it, I mean, there were a few headlines. It's not like the World Press Freedom Index thing was unreported, but it's just buried so far away from, I mean, you'd have to really go out and find it. You'd have to be thinking one day, oh, I wonder how Britain's performing in the World Press rankings. I better go and Google it. You know, that you would really have to search for it. And I mean, I spoke recently down in London at an event for the University of Sussex. And we were discussing kind of media bias, fake news, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And it was actually World Press Freedom Day. And most people in the room still felt like Britain was leading the world in terms of the freedom of its press. And you go, there are 39 other countries that have a freer press than us. Most people I know would struggle to list 39 countries, let alone 39 that, you know, that they actually thought would be in advance of the UK in terms of press freedom. And obviously it was, this again comes back to the Conservative Party, because of course it was a large reason for our slide down the press freedom rankings was the Investigatory Powers Act that May passed recently, which has just had a chilling effect on press freedom.
Absolutely. And just to sort of make one broad point out of this, if you like, I think the fact the media don't report on this, especially the press freedom stuff, and they push the narrative that the public is supposed to be adopting and listening to as all about Brexit or all about immigration. It's just an absolutely calamitous situation, because this press freedom thing should be top of the headlines, because it undermines everything else in the country. If you have a restricted press, as we patently do in this country, if you have restricted press and everything else is irrelevant, because you're not getting the truth anyway. So it's a massive issue that really needs to be addressed. But
hi, this is Nancy from the Canary. This being our first podcast, we thought we'd break to say hello. Before we hear about Steve's second story, we wanted to tell you how to get in touch with us. We're on Twitter at CanaryPod or email podcast@thecanary.co. We'd love to hear your thoughts and suggestions for future podcasts, so do get in touch. And now, back to Kerri-Anne and Steve.
Isn't it convenient that as we go into the election, that the bulk of the media focuses, as you say, making this election all about Brexit and immigration, when, you know, there is so much other stuff going on? And on that topic, we shall segue neatly on from the UN report into Tory dirty money. This has been a dogged battle, hasn't it? I mean, that you've got these So I'll just introduce this for people who are new to this. So essentially you have an extraordinary campaign group called Move Your Money. They've done fantastic work over years and years and years on kind of exposing that kind of the murkiness and the dirtiness that happens in the City of London and how that influences our politics and the very real connections of power and influence between our financial services industry and our political system. And we need these researchers doing this work. It is absolutely vitally important. And they'd basically done years of research into the story that we're going to discuss shortly around kind of HSBC's relationship with Michael Spencer and donations to the Conservative Party and the impact that may have had on the 2010 general election. So we picked up this from social media. We'd had a few conversations with a researcher from Move Your Money. We'd had a look at this kind of hashtag Tory dirty money, like gaining power. And then we had actually MPs picking up on this issue, and even the SNP's Roger Mullin writing a letter to the Electoral Commission demanding an urgent investigation. So at this point, we felt like, having gone through the research, having had it been escalated to the level of politics and a request for an investigation by the Electoral Commission, that this was fair game for us to report upon. I tell you what, Steve, why don't we split the labour here? Do you want to fill people in on what the story is? What are the key allegations and the evidence behind them?
Nuts and bolts of this story are, okay, former Conservative Party Treasurer Michael Spencer owns and runs a company called IPGL. It's a brokerage company based out of London. In 2008, HSBC made a £214 million loan to IPGL. At the time, IPGL was donating money anywhere in between the region of £500 million in one go to over £1 million in one go, totaling £4.6 million in donations to the Conservative Party. Now, at the time, IPGL and several of its subsidiary companies were in financial trouble. A firm called City Index, which is a subsidiary of IPGL, reported £43 million worth of losses. Spencer had to put in £70 million of his own money to bail out this particular company. And so what Move Your Money and the investigators there came up with was that there could be issues here surrounding HSBC's actions with regards to loaning money to politically exposed persons, and because what was happening with that money at the time when the company was in financial difficulties could have possibly broken financial law.
What happened when we published our report?
Yes. Look, in my eyes, and I know it's in your eyes as well, this is a perfectly legitimate, valid story. Yep. However, what happened? Our friends at BuzzFeed, who have always supported us unwaveringly. No, they haven't. Our friends at BuzzFeed decided to pick up this story and do what they thought was an excellent debunking job on this. Their journalist, James Ball, formerly of The Guardian, took my article and the surrounding investigation into it and thought that he'd kind of ripped it apart and picked holes on it, and basically came to the conclusion that there was nothing in this story. It was all sort of canary conspiracy, if you like, that no case to answer, nothing to see here, move away. And then the BBC's Victoria Derbyshire programme decided to get James Ball from BuzzFeed on to talk about why he thought it was all conspiracy theory and nothing to see here, without giving us, who investigated and wrote the story, a right of reply at all. However, this story is not conspiracy theory. There is hard, solid facts and evidence behind it. As you, Mrs. Mendoza, quite rightly pointed out in an editorial on Thursday, the 11th of May, which went down quite a storm on social media. So, yeah, it's been a bit of a roller coaster with this one. I mean, look, to be honest, it was a hard enough story to actually get together.
Yeah.
Put across to the reader in such a way that it was accessible without watering down the facts, if you like. Because look, any story surrounding the financial services industry is always complex because there's so much regulation as well. There's so many technicalities and technical language that trying to get it across in a manner which everyone can understand is always a challenge.
Absolutely.
And it was a real fight to be able to do the story, if you like, and to have BuzzFeed just do some cat-handed, half-baked research into my story and completely dismiss it was not unexpected, because that's what we do best. However, it's frustrating, to say the least.
Yeah, I think probably the thing that frustrated me most was then it kind of becomes a whole, BuzzFeed versus the Canary, you know, and that's the story then. It becomes a dust-up between two media outlets, and that's really never what this story was about. There are serious allegations being made here and really troubling evidence supporting them. And you know, campaigners and researchers have been working on this for years. They've worked diligently. And then to have all of that effort and work, you know, when it was building up steam, getting to the point where you would potentially hope to have it be unignorable because it's, you know, there could be a potential investigation happening. You know, BuzzFeed come along and just make it, you know, for want of a better word, a pissing contest.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just honestly, I was so frustrated about it because I just, you know, I can imagine being the campaigners who've been working on this and the level of frustration you would feel having worked so hard, you know, for so long to actually attempt to bring this issue to light. And then some hack somewhere spends half a day, you know.
It defies and beggars belief that BuzzFeed would want to do this anyway. I mean, and as you say, it shouldn't be some tit-for-tat war between BuzzFeed and the Canary. We never wanted that. It was BuzzFeed who decided to turn it into this. And it undermines not only us, but it undermines what they do by picking apart a story which is so fundamental to giving a perspective on how this country and the world is run, if you like. It's important to say on this is the crux of the story, and I'll lead into you then debunking the BuzzFeed bit. This is what BuzzFeed categorically got wrong. They claimed this was about electoral law, and this is unfortunately also where Roger Mullins from the SNP went slightly wrong. They claimed it's about electoral law. I never stated in my first article when we overviewed this that it was about electoral law. I specifically said it was about whether HSBC had broken financial regulations lending this money, knowing full well, because they must have known because they had IPGL's accounts, whether they broke regulations surrounding politically exposed persons about the donation of loans from third parties to political parties, whether they should have conducted risk assessments on lending money to Spencer, knowing he was a prominent political figure, and whether this breached any more of their regulations. This was never about electoral law. This was about financial regulation and the impact on the donations to the Conservative Party. That was the crux of it. And this is what BuzzFeed completely misunderstood, along with loads of other things, which I think you're going to outline now.
I am indeed. And that really is crucial. I mean, I write in the editorial, you know, you kind of, the things that are absolute, two things are absolutely essential if you're going to debunk a story. One of them is that you accurately represent the claims that you're out to debunk. And the second is that you provide robust evidence for that debunking.
They would help, wouldn't they?
That's, you know, I hate to, you know, teach grandma to suck eggs, but that's how debunking works. And that was absolutely not what BuzzFeed did here. And as you said, they started off from a faulty premise to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to go through claims made by BuzzFeed and what was wrong with them. So firstly, I mean, literally the first mistake in the BuzzFeed post is in the first sentence. So Ball claims that this story was born on the Canary. That's false. Mm-hmm. The story actually originated, as we said, with Move Your Money. It was raised at the HSBC annual general meeting on the 28th of April. Mm-hmm. It was escalated to the Electoral Commission by Roger Mullin. I mean, it was commented on by Labour MP John. I mean, this story was everywhere except the mainstream media.
Can I just chip in at this point? Just
you certainly can.
Just to put some sort of timescale onto this, John Mann made these first claims about what was going on with IPGL in 2012. This is not... the Canary, I didn't sit down like last week and think, God, I'm bored, I need to find a story to write. Oh, I know, HSBC and the Tory party. John Mann raised this in 2012. Anyway.
It's just crazy, isn't it? Ball then goes on to say, and this is a quote, he says, it's true that IPGL lost money in 2008 and 2009. He gives the figures for how much was lost. He says, but this was largely due to the effects of the financial crisis. And, you know, it's not the same as being in crisis. If a company's at serious risk of not lasting through the year, its directors and auditors are required to note this concern. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know that's also not true. Yeah. Because what Ball has actually left out is that 6 weeks before making the 1.03 million donation to the Tories in 2010, IPGL was in talks with the Financial Services Authority about its strength. And that was due to a profit warning from ICAP, which is a firm that IPGL has shares in, and the losses from a subsidiary called City Index. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all, again, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah.
Information that is easily researchable for anyone who has an interest in this issue.
I know, right? I didn't go hacking emails or like or going in disguise to some backstreet office of IPGL or something. This is all just under Companies House on the internet available. You just have to take some time to look through it. So obviously James Ball was on a tight schedule that day.
It really shows in there. It was almost with each claim, I can remember sort of reading through the BuzzFeed report and thinking, surely no one's going to take this seriously. Like, this is so, so poor.
Yes.
And then kind of seeing, you know, journalist after journalist in the kind of establishment media sharing it, going, this is such a brilliant debunking.
Yeah.
And just going, oh my God, no, literally none of these people know their stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, I'm either they know their stuff and they're lying,
mm-hmm.
which is bad, or they literally haven't even done enough research.
I think it's in part what some of it is. It's slightly a bit of contempt for us, if you like, I have to say.
Yeah.
I think it's that people assume because we're not establishment journalists who haven't done degrees in journalism and haven't done internships and we're the new canary, oh, they must have got it wrong. They always make mistakes. If you look back at when we do make errors, we always put them as a pin post on Facebook, being open and honest, saying, look, hands up, sorry, we've done this. And they are few and far between. So
So on we go. Ball writes, quote, crucially though, over the period of 2008 to 2010, IPGL was actually paying this money back to HSBC rather than drawing more. By the time the company filed its 2008 accounts, it had reduced total borrowing from £352 million to £250 million, and by February 2010, it had paid back more than £80 million of its HSBC loan.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, if you're reading that, you're going, yes, indeed, so they're paying it back, it's all above board. But, of course, there was an issue with that as well, because what Ball doesn't say is that IPGL only managed to pay that back due to Spencer selling £45 million of his and IPGL shares in another company called ICAP
mm-hmm.
to pay back the loan. So essentially you've got Spencer having to sell his own shares to raise the cash to pay back the loan. And this was actually noted by the Financial Services Authority.
Yeah.
Do you want to speak to that, Steve? Because, I mean, this is a really big issue. This was the Telegraph newspaper has in the past, you know, Peter Oborn, one of its leading journalists, quit.
Mm.
Because of the lack of probity the Telegraph, he alleges, provided HSBC because of their relationship with HSBC Bank as an advertiser. Now, Steve, which paper was it that had reported this correction?
Hang on, let me ruffle through my notes here. Oh, it was the Telegraph. This is a crucial bit of the story. To put it in like layman's terms, if you like, basically what Spencer and IPGL did was to get this HSBC loan and to pay it back. They based it on saying that shares that they held were assets. Like, for example, when you get a mortgage, it's staked against your house, property, bricks and mortar. So they were using shares in the same way. Now, the FSA took issue with that because basically they said shares are not assets. The fundamental reason for that is because the value of shares can go up and down.
Absolutely.
It's not fixed. There's no way of being able to permanently quantify how much you are offering up to take out a loan, because it changes all the time. And the FSA said this is not an asset, and it in essence was breaching regulations. And this is crucial to this story because it sums up the whole, if you like, notion of what this story is about, that this money is slightly dodgy, it's flouting industry regulations, and this money is being funneled into the Conservative Party.
Yeah, and I think, again, as you say, it comes back to the point, this is a financial services story. Politics plays a part, but where the potential, you know, breaks in regulation and perhaps law happened, well, not at the political end, they were actually at the money end.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, look, to play devil's advocate, and in all fairness, theoretically, the Conservative Party didn't do anything wrong taking this money. They haven't broken the electoral law. They did nothing wrong in taking £4.6 million from IPGL. The question lies whether IPGL and HSBC acted correctly, and ultimately that poses the question, if these two companies did act incorrectly, then that would question the actual donations themselves. That's the crux of the issue. And in a fair and just world, if this money was found to be dodgy, the Conservative Party should theoretically have to pay it back. However, as we saw with Tory election fraud this week, that doesn't always work out.
No, sadly not.
Sadly not.
It comes to something, doesn't it, when you've got a government actually crowing about the fact that they were the first ever party to be investigated for electoral fraud and being handed an unprecedentedly high fine for and they're actually celebrating it like they won. I find it absurd that there's just zero humility with these people at all.
No, absolutely.
Absolutely zero.
And what it is, it just shows the whitewash we get in the UK press, because it was touted as, after the Crown Prosecution Service, CPS, drew their conclusions, it was touted essentially that the Conservatives were off the hook. They're not off the hook. They broke electoral law and they overspent. The problem is, all the CPS said in essence was that it wasn't intentional and there was no deception in their eyes. So that doesn't mean that the Tories didn't overspend. They still flouted the spending regulations, but apparently they didn't do it on purpose. So
quite a phenomenal precedent to have been set, isn't it? In that it can be proven that all of the allegations are true, except, just don't think they did it in a mean way.
Yeah. Essentially. It is quite a remarkable precedent set. Of course, they're still investigating one MP from Kent, and if my judgment serves me correctly, my gut feeling is that the MP they're investigating in Kent will probably be charged, just as a little token gesture to make sure they seem to be doing something. So
it's actually, certainly for listeners as well, it's really worth going out looking at the Twitter feeds of Mr. Ethical and Joel Benjamin from Move Your Money, because literally these guys have been predicting this outcome for months. Like this was not a surprise to anyone. I mean, I've been so occasionally we get the odd comment on the Facebook page of people going, "You told us, you know, the Conservatives are going to jail," as if like we're the CPS.
Yeah.
It's not our fault. We're not the CPS. We can't actually put Conservatives in jail. We can only raise the issues. We're not judge, jury, and executioner. We're the press.
No, quite. Hopefully, give it 10 years, Kerri-Anne, and we might be able to jail them. We'll see.
Gulags, one day, Steve. One day. This is, as you touched upon there, actually, there is a real link here between our slide down the world press rankings and this particular issue around Tory dirty money and the election expenses fraud, because I think not much shows why we have slipped down those rankings as much as the lack of reporting on these stories. I mean, it has been staggering. I mean, we've been on election expenses now for, 14, 15 months?
Yes.
And other than Channel 4 News, there has been nothing happening anywhere in the mainstream press about this. I mean, The Mirror, I think, had one journalist on it, Nick Summerland.
Yeah, correct.
Most other outlets.
Yeah, and all they
like, not even mention it.
What Channel 4 have done anyway.
Completely. They might, on like page 15, you might have The Guardian say, by the way, Channel 4 said a thing, moving on.
Yeah.
It's this is the biggest political scandal probably in history.
Yes.
I mean, you're talking about, it's as serious as it gets.
Yeah.
Did the Conservative Party buy the 2015 general election? Were these expenses misdeclared? We now know they were misdeclared. No one is arguing with that. The CPS isn't arguing with that. The police isn't arguing with that.
Yeah.
The Electoral Commission isn't arguing with that. That is now a fact, a recorded fact.
The thing is, for me, Kerri-Anne, in my worldview, if you like, this story about Tory election fraud and our story about Tory dirty money, what they do, however, they encapsulate the problem that we have as a society. Because essentially what you are witnessing with these stories is what I and many other journalists refer to as corporatism in action. That mm-hmm. is, if you like, the blurred lines between where big business begins and where politicians ends. It's this, if you like, embedding and marrying of politicians to corporations that yeah. make all of the decisions for us, that influence is how politicians govern because of the money that's involved in corporations. These stories are, in essence, just pure unadulterated corporatism, especially the HSBC one. You've got one of the biggest banks and corporations in the world, essentially seeing its money flowing into the Conservative Party. And let's be very clear about this. HSBC have had huge influence over both the new Labour government and the Conservative government. For example, Stephen Green, former CEO of HSBC, was then appointed as Minister of Trade and Investment by Dave Cameron. Douglas yeah. Flint, former chairman of HSBC, was given a position at HMRC in 2007 by the new Labour government to oversee large corporations' tax bill. I mean, and he was the chairman of HSBC. It's just preposterous. But
we've also got Rona Fairhead as well. Obviously, yeah. the BBC Trust is now wound down. The Ofcom will now be overseeing the BBC. Yes. But prior to that, it was the BBC Trust run by Rona Fairhead.
Who sat at the Cabinet Office. I mean, and that's what I mean.
It's staggering. She was a long-term friend of George Osborne. Yes. She sat in the Cabinet Office. They made her chair of the BBC Trust mm-hmm. when her previous role was she was leading HSBC Bank at the time that it was found guilty of money laundering mm-hmm. from Mexican drug cartels
yes.
and a whole litany of other breaches. So you then have Rona Fairhead move from HSBC effectively into Conservative government and then back out into the BBC as almost the Conservatives' media arm.
Yes.
At the same time that George Osborne is over in the US lobbying to make sure that Rona and her friends at HSBC don't get charged with any crimes.
Absolutely. And as I say, this is corporatism in action. It is yeah. the essence of the way of, I mean, a lot of people say we live under capitalism. In my opinion, we don't. Naomi Klein wrote about it in her 2007 book, The Shock Doctrine, where she described corporatism and exactly what it is. And we have moved way beyond neoliberal capitalism now. This is essentially corporatism. And these stories, and as you say about Rona Fairhead, her transition from HSBC to government to the BBC is a prime example of corporatism in action.
Absolutely. It's kind of, you know, poacher gamekeeper.
Correct.
Yeah. So in a revolving door, isn't yeah. it? Okay, I'm conscious that we're running low on yes. time, so I think we'll probably bring it to a halt. But I would just reiterate that book that Steve recommended there for listeners to read. Absolutely read Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine. I would also recommend reading Professor Steve Keen's book, Debunking Economics. Both of these books are absolutely fantastic ways that you can, I mean, it's very difficult to get through the scale of what's happening in a sort of 40 minute podcast or an 800 word article. What these books allow you to do is sit down for a period of time and really bury your head in, you know, what is broken and actually how we might fix it.
Absolutely.
Because I believe we can, but it does rest on us actually getting to consensus on what the problems are first.
Yes. Can I make one final point?
Absolutely. Go for it, Topple.
Both the UN report and the HSBC story are, as you say, two of the biggest stories we ran this week, but they are also crucial. The UN investigation is the third one now. The second one they carried out reported that the UK government had committed grave and systematic violations of disabled people's human rights. And the first yeah. one was saying that they had done the same to single parents, the poor, the vulnerable, the sick. This is ongoing. The HSBC story is about dodgy money flowing into the Conservative Party. People only have one way to fix this. They need to get out and vote on June the 8th. However you vote, Labour, Green, Lib Dem, SNP, Plaid or spoil your ballot, it is imperative that people do exercise their right and vote, because otherwise nothing's going to change with this. The Tories won't act on HSBC. The UN recommendations aren't legally binding, so the Tories can wash their hands of them. The only way we're going to change yeah. this is to vote. And however you do it, make sure you do.
Absolutely. And that's the thing to remember. It's no good allowing these pieces of bad news to make you apathetic or resigned to that things can change. Because frankly, that's what they're up to. like apathy and resignation, like that's like crack to these people. I mean, yeah. You know, it helps them. It helps them that we're passive observers.
Exactly.
We need to get active and involved in local campaigns, local politics, however you can get involved, do. And on that note, I'll bring our show to a close. Thanks ever so much for joining me today, Steve. It's been fantastic to get your insight and just delve deeper into the stories that you've written this week.
Really enjoyed it. That was great.
Awesome. And we'll be back with you listeners next week with more behind the scenes from the Canary. Take care. Wishing you well this week.